getting some of the members of the Arab or Islamic world to help us with ISIS. Again, this is just an example of where their policies are deeply contradictory and therefore are unlikely to succeed.
Finally, you just tweeted, new theory, you just tweeted, the media is not covering terrorism. Is Trump serious, delusional, incurably dishonest, all of the above? Donald Trump falsely claiming Monday during a speech to U.S. CENTCOM in Florida at the MacDill Air Base that the media is intentionally covering up terrorist attacks. Your response?
Well, again, I think that there's no evidence of this at all. If anything, I think the media has overcovered the problem of terrorism really ever since 9/11. It's why Americans greatly exaggerate the actual risk they are under. The risk that Americans face from a terrorist attack here in the United States is astronomically small, sort of one chance in 4 million. There are so many other things that are much more of a danger to us, much more of a problem that we should be worrying about.
We're going to have to leave it there. Professor Stephen Walt, thanks so much for joining us, Professor of International Relations at Harvard University. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
This is Love Jones, producer of The World Famous Confessional. This year, Contessa de la Luna brings you a real bona fide Wild West jamboree and variety show. We've got live performances by Contessa de la Luna and Courtney Vondrail from Three Lake Torso, plus audience lasso contests, sock puppet theater, surprise fun box drawing, many other prizes. We've got performances by the Sea Charms and a selfie booth with Contessa de la Luna. We've got plenty of surprises and fun in store, so mark your calendars Thursday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds benefit KBOO, your community radio station. Tickets are available now online at contessawestern.brownpapertickets.com or at the door the night of the event. Get your hat, get your spurs, and come on down Thursday, February 9th at the Clinton Street Theater starting at 7 p.m. Contessa de la Luna's Wild West Jamboree, an old-time variety show.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, taking place Thursdays through Sundays until March 4th at PCC Cascade in Portland. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a Vision of Africa package for Western viewers. The films celebrate Africa's achievements, expose its failures, and reveal possibilities for a hopeful future. The festival includes live music performances, plays and short films, documentary, and a Women's Filmmakers Week. Again, that's the 27th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, Thursday through Sundays until March 4th, at Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at Portland Community College, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information and specific times for the screenings can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The time is now 5:02 p.m. Next is your evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mike Pence breaks a deadlock in the Senate to confirm Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education.
And the easement has been granted by the Army to move forward with the Dakota Access Pipeline's construction.
And we have BARC live in studio to talk about their upcoming BARC Bout hike that includes some snowshoeing. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 7th, 2017, day 18 of living in Trump's alternative universe. I'm Candace Lessinger.
And I'm Jenna Yokoyama. Betsy DeVos was confirmed by the Senate today as Secretary of Education by the tie-breaking vote of Mike Pence. This is the first time a vice president has been called upon to break a tie in the confirmation of a cabinet member in history. The DeVos vote was scheduled to be before that of Jeff Sessions, as if he had already been confirmed as Secretary of State, he would have had to resign his seat and not been there to vote, which could have made the outcome different. Known for her ties to the Reformed Christian community, DeVos has championed school choice voucher programs and has served as a board chairman of Alliance of School Choice. Senate Democrats spent the night talking on the floor in united opposition to DeVos's nomination, hoping to lure Republicans to cross party lines. Two Republicans, Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, did just that, resulting in a 50-50 tie vote. This is Senator Jeff Merkley speaking last night from the Senate floor in a filibuster.
We are down here speaking through the night to raise the issue of why the nominee for Secretary of Education is so completely inappropriate. We see the passion that has arisen across America. Ordinary citizens calling us up on the phone, inundating our phones with thousands of phone calls. I had more phone calls in a single day than I normally get in a couple of weeks. Inundating us with thousands of emails, letters. And why is there so much public passion about this nomination? The short answer is that public education is a cherished institution in the United States of America. Public schools are a vital pathway through which our children have the opportunity to gain the knowledge that allows them to thrive in our society. And we don't want to see that system of public education, that gateway for a successful life, destroyed by Betsy DeVos. That's why the American people are sending us so many letters and so many emails and making so many phone calls. Because Betsy DeVos has no education experience, no public school experience. And our students and our teachers and our communities, our nation, deserve leadership that does have public education experience, who does have, someone who does have a passion for the success of every child. Not someone who's simply dedicated to trying to tear down public schools so she can run private profit institutions and put money in the bank. What do we really care about in the United States of America? Do we care about the education of our children or about an entrepreneur hijacking the public education system for personal profit? That's why the citizens of this country are so outraged by this nomination and outraged that senators on this floor are planning to vote for her.
That was Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley speaking last night from the Senate floor in a filibuster to apparently no one.
The United States Army Corps of Engineers has announced that they will be granting an easement to Energy Transfer Partners to finish construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. This comes shortly after Donald Trump signed a presidential memorandum ordering the expedition of the easement last week. Trump's memorandum also called for the revival of the Keystone XL pipeline. The Keystone XL pipeline could carry crude oil from the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska, where it would connect with an existing pipeline to bring the oil all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Last week, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe said they would take legal action if the easement was granted. However, the Army Corps has only given the Senate a 24-hour notice and not the required 14 days, which means construction can continue by Thursday. The Department of something was unavailable for comment.
Remain a mystery, I guess. February 15th is Exclusion Day, which means that children who aren't vaccinated or don't have a medical or non-medical exemption by then won't be allowed in schools. The state law applies to all children in public and private schools, preschools, Head Start, and certified child care centers. Exclusion letters have been sent to 8,000 families with unvaccinated children, alerting them to this deadline. Officials said that parents who received a letter should take their children's immunization records and health card to their health care provider or clinic. The hepatitis A vaccine is required for children and students 18 months and older. The DTaP or Tdap vaccination is required for students in grades 7 through 12. Tdap is the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, whooping cough booster. Multnomah County is holding clinics on February 11th and 15th to help those without insurance and who are underinsured get caught up. KBOO spoke with Dr. Jen Vine of the Multnomah County Health Department to learn more about their upcoming immunization clinics.
So the deadline is February 16th, that's next Wednesday, and there are two more opportunities for kids and families to get vaccines at the state. One is this Saturday, the 11th, from 10 o'clock to 2 p.m. at the David Douglas Administration Building of the 730th Avenue. The next one for those who are waiting until the last minute is next Wednesday, the day of, that's the 16th. And that's an immunization clinic at the East County Services Building, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's at Northeast 8th Street in Russia.
They're being offered at a reduced cost, correct?
Yeah, in general, vaccines for children are offered at no cost. And of course, our goal is to get kids in school and up to date on their vaccines so that we're all protected as community.
And so you guys will have all the vaccines that students will need in order to attend school, correct?
Correct. Well, yeah, we'll be ready with vaccines that kids are required to have for school.
So they're free for students under 18 and still in high school, or is there any sort of, what is the age limit and stuff?
So in general, for under 18 and still in kids, the vaccine for children's program provides the vaccine essentially in a class.
And where can people go if they just want to find more information about this and the list of all the vaccines that are being offered?
Mm-hmm. So they can go to the Multnomah County website, and that's multpro.us.
Why is it important for students to get immunized?
Well, you know, vaccines keep us all safe. And having our school exclusion day gives us a chance not so much to penalize kids who are out of date, but to get everyone on the same page with their vaccines up to date and all of it protected against things like whooping cough, measles, diseases that are very much alive and well in the world.
That was Dr. Jen Vine of the Multnomah County Health Department. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenny Okuyama. A bicycle rider died yesterday morning in a collision with a truck on North Interstate Avenue in North Portland. The accident occurred around 9 a.m. at the intersection of Interstate and Farragut. Bike Portland's report described it as a classic right hook. It is the first death of a bicycle death here in Portland of the year. The operator of a large white box van was driving northbound on Interstate and then turned right onto Farragut. The bicycle rider also happened to be traveling northbound. The interstate in this location is relatively narrow due to the presence of a center running Max Light rail line. Portland bicycle advocates have been speaking out about the number of bicycle fatalities as the city's bike population increases. The city has implemented an action plan called Vision Zero, which aims to eliminate traffic violence by 2015.
A march in Hillsborough is scheduled today as a call for the town to be declared a sanctuary city like Portland in Beaverton. The decision vote among city councilors is scheduled for March 7th, while sanctuary city proposals came up in a city hall meeting last year. The rally and march will have police intervention and supervision. The event participants congregated at 5 p.m. and are scheduled to march for 1 mile at 6 p.m.
For over a decade, Oregon has been situated at or near the bottom nationally when it comes to the total effective business tax rate, according to the lobbying group Council on State Taxation, also known as COST. The most recent version of the study found that the total state and local taxes paid by Oregon businesses amounted to 3.6% of Oregon's private sector economy. That was higher than only three states, Alaska, Connecticut, and North Carolina, and tied with three others, Michigan, Indiana, and Missouri. Oregon's business tax rate of 3.5% puts the state tied at 45th. The national average was 4.6%. Since the late 1970s, corporate income tax contributions have shrunk by more than half as a share of the state's economy. Oregon now confronts a major budget gap. Last week, Governor Kate Brown opened a strategic bargaining process with the state legislature, setting out a mix of new revenues and cuts to close a $1.7 billion budget gap.
If you're feeling stressed out, you're not alone. Life is stressful these days, and we here at KBOO Evening News care a lot about the well-being of you, our listeners. So we're going to introduce a new segment that's just a few seconds of the sound of a relaxing, flowing creek. Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Transpositive at 6. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Today's weather is looking like most days here in Bridge City, with rain all day, the high 41 and low 40. East of the Cascades and Hood River, expect snow in the morning and rain in the afternoon with a high of 34 and a low of 33. Today in history, in 2011, the Bowling Green Massacre did not occur. But what did occur was Charlie Chaplin's premiere of his character, the Tramp, in 1914. The quote of the day comes from the final speech of Charlie Chaplin's film, The Dictator, where he said, quote, "The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish."
It is 5:15, which I believe means it's time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Tromp, tromp, tromp. Troops are marching to battle. Boom, boom, boom. Bombs are blowing up communities. Whoosh. Poisonous gas is being released. Forget Syria, ISIS, Iran, Afghanistan. This is Trump's war. Our bellicose commander-in-chief is at war in the homeland, deploying his troops to attack everything from our public schools to the EPA, dropping executive order bombs on Muslim communities in the Mexican border, and spewing poisonous tweets of bigotry and right-wing bile at the media, scientists, inner cities, illegal voters, Meryl Streep, diplomats, Democrats, people who use real facts and, well, Trump is at war with the American majority, with all who do not agree with him. And you thought Nixon had a long enemies list. Yet, Trump's most destructive assault so far has not targeted any one group, but an essential and existential concept: truth. Bluntly put, he's psychotic, believing that truth is whatever he says it is, and that he can change it tomorrow. Years ago, in a futuristic novel, the author wrote about the rise of a tyrannical regime that ruled by indoctrinating the masses to accept the perverse notion of capricious truth. It was George Orwell's 1984, which depicted a dystopia he named Oceania. There, the public had been inculcated to believe that reality is not, quote, something objective, external, existing in its own right. Rather, whatever the party holds to be truth is truth. Now, in 2017, we live in Trumplandia, with a delusional leader of a plutocratic party trying to redefine reality with alternative facts and fake news. This is Jim Hightower saying, but resistance is already surging, including the fact that Orwell's 70-year-old book has become a bestseller again, thanks to Trump resistors seeking, you know, truth.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Michigan Republicans running state government are about to try again to cut retiree medical care and pensions for public workers. Mark Dougherty is president of the Michigan Professional Firefighters Union. He says Michigan Republicans aren't looking for ways to fund the pension promises made to public employees. They're just looking to slash the benefits.
I want them to come up with a thoughtful solution on how we can maintain them. We want to see pre-funding. We want to see these benefits be maintained. I don't want to see them just cut. And far too often that's the answer we're seeing, is just cut the benefits.
Michigan Governor Rick Snyder claims there's a $14 billion unfunded liability for pensions and retiree health care benefits. Michigan has no state pension system for public employees. It's all done locally. But state Republicans still want to cut the retirement benefit of public workers throughout the state. Dougherty says firefighters retire typically in their 50s and have a host of injuries and health issues that need to be covered for years before Medicare kicks in.
Our retiree health care benefit is important because we tend to retire sooner. We retire in our early 50s, typically in the mid-50s. we have a 10 to 15 year gap before we get on Medicare. So we leave the fire service in retirement, usually with chronic injuries. We have a 62% rate of cancer. We have PTSD issues. And these are all things that are very important to us to be taken care of. That's a very important issue for us to make sure we maintain this benefit.
Mesa flight attendants are taking a strike vote later this month. The AFA-CWA represents Mesa workers. They've been in labor contract talks for years that are now stalled. The union says they are underpaid compared to other flight attendants flying for United and American Airlines. Mesa is based in Phoenix. AFA-CWA represents 700 Mesa flight attendants. If they vote to authorize a strike, the workers can't call the strike until the National Mediation Board declares talks at an impasse. A 30-day cooling-off period is also required after that before a strike could start. Yale may appeal an NLRB January 2017 ruling that approved the union election for Yale grad student workers. The NLRB order was for 9 separate elections in different departments employing grad student workers at Yale. Yale now says it's considering appealing the ruling. Yale's Office of General Counsel is working to determine whether the university should request a review of the decision with the NLRB. The union election dates haven't yet been set.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org. Brought to you by Union Active, your certified iOS and Android mobile app developer, offering high-quality, union-made mobile apps backed by a support team which upgrades your product to every new mobile operating system. Features, pricing, and examples are online at unionactive.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's time for our monthly BARC check-in. This month, BARC will be featuring a hike where participants will learn about wildlife tracking. BARC is teaming up with Cascadia Wild for this winter hike that will take participants out into the snow for some tracking and snowshoeing. Also this month, BARC will be having its volunteer orientation. Here to talk to us and tell us more about BARC's upcoming events is BARC community organizer Courtney Ray and hike leader Lila Brown of Cascadia Wild. Thank you both for joining us here today.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, nice to be here.
So for our listeners who have never been on one, what is a BARC hike about?
BARC About hikes are volunteer-led hikes into Mount Hood National Forest. Generally, we take folks to a place that has some special wildlife activity or ecological issues going on. Sometimes we take folks into forest that is logged or due to be logged. And it's our opportunity to bring people in Portland to parts of the forest that they might not see on a typical trail or the typical recreation sites.
And Cascadia Wild will be partnering with BARC for this month's hike, right? So Lila, can you tell us a little bit about Cascade Wild?
Cascadia Wild, we are a nonprofit organization and we've been around quite a while here in the Portland area. And tracking is one of our primary things that we teach and do. And we use it to do a really amazing citizen science survey of Mount Hood. And with that, we are partnering with the biologists at the Forest Service because the type of data that we can gather, both as citizens going out with lots and lots of people, and as well as using tracking, is a certain type of data that's unique that the Forest Service isn't able to gather as an organization in the way that they're set up. So we also teach kind of like survival skills classes and plant ID and things like that. And our website is cascadiawild.org.
Cool. So let's talk about tracking for a second. This hike is going to be about wildlife tracking. What is it, first of all? I think like people might have a general understanding of what that word means, but what is it specifically with Cascadia Wild, and why is tracking a beneficial skill when it comes to conservation?
Well, that is a really great question. Tracking, I mean, it's also a very large answer, but tracking is a traditional human skill. So it's something that is really the birthright for every human being. And a lot of people think that that activity is one of the ways that made our brains develop the way that they do. We can think in time and we generate all these stories. And a lot of people believe that that comes from reading signs on the landscape. And when we look at tracks, You know, that when we talk about a track, we are talking about like the footprint of an animal or some part of their body that touched the ground. But that also includes other types of sign. So like, you know, feeding sign or woodpecker sign on a tree. A lot of birds don't leave a lot of footprints on the ground because they're flying. So even, you know, like a nest or a place where an animal like a elk has browsed or scraped, you know, that's all within tracking. And what we do is we generate kind of like best guesses based on the physical, tangible, visible information in the landscape. And, you know, the way that we do science right now is kind of like we, you know, it's things that you can fill in a spreadsheet. And that's how we're doing land management as well. But with tracking, we have a goal of kind of like trying to gather as much complex information as possible before we create the story, our best guess of what happened in that place or what type of animal that was. And so what happens is there's a lot more like kind of like nuance for living creatures and complex interactions in the ecosystem. And so a lot of biology surveys, especially wildlife biology, are starting to use tracking more and more and hire people who are professional trackers because they're finding that it goes really well with other types of wildlife observation, like having a camera that automatically takes a picture when an animal walks by. You know, if they don't walk right past your camera, then you're not going to see what animal that was. But if you have a tracker working for you, then they'll be able to read the sign on the landscape and tell you who came close while they're checking the batteries and things like that. So, and we've been working on Mount Hood for a couple decades, actually.
Wow, that's super fascinating. So with all the snow we've had this year, are you anticipating that that's going to be a feature of this hike? And are you going to be snowshoeing? And how does that affect tracking? Sorry, that's like three questions, but...
No, it's okay. I'm really glad you asked that because one thing that people should know if they're planning to come to this hike is that, you know, this is as soon as we leave like the pavement, and even sometimes then, it's you can basically consider it like a survival situation. So if every one person has everything that they need to like live out the day or, you know, make it through the night in an emergency on this trip, then we'll all make sure that we can take care of each other. But if any one person isn't prepared, like if they don't have their long johns or if they're wearing lots of cotton, then that will put every member of the group at risk. So please be prepared for kind of like winter conditions, have waterproof layer and plenty of layers of warm clothes, and good shoes is really important. So thanks for asking that. We
should
will
people
be,
bring snowshoes?
Yeah, people should bring snowshoes if they want and bark. And Cascadia Wild, there will be a couple pairs that people can reserve if they want. So I believe they can contact bark.
They can. They can also rent snowshoes at the mountain store or at Next Adventure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's really inexpensive to rent snowshoes for the day and totally worth it.
So who should go on this hike? Is it open to all ages and walks? And is it for people who are in particularly good shape?
Well, we usually have plenty of people and, you know, we've had as many as 60 folks come on this hike. So be prepared to, you know, like break out into little groups. We'll try to have trackers that can be with everybody, but we'll go at the pace of the slowest person for sure. And we actually having little kids on hikes like this or even elders, you know, as long as people are able to walk, you know, a mile, it really makes the experience better for everyone. Especially kids are amazing trackers right out of the gate. So,
and for maybe people who haven't been snowshoeing before, would this be an okay hike for them to try it out for the first time?
Absolutely.
Is it free?
Yes. All of Bark's events, any hike, any radical training, anything we have at the office or in the forest, it's always free. We have a lot of members who contribute to our work, and so we're able to offer that to the public.
Just one more question. So as someone who tracks and, you know, your organization's been out there, if you said, for 20 years now, what kind of animal tracks would you anticipate seeing this time of year out in the snow?
So we're going to a new area. We were going to one particular area on the north side of the mountain, but because that was like a contended possible timber sale region. And when we were there, we pretty much every year we saw bobcat sign. We saw some really unusual stuff, including animals from the weasel family. So those are some of our indicator species that actually can trigger conservation. And we were able to, like, we weren't doing an official survey, so we didn't document those. But there's always a lot of sign. And, you know, you can never be in any patch of forest that doesn't have animal sign in it, basically. And it's nice to get a nice clear trail. And so that's, we're going to all kind of like hope for that day. But I don't think anyone in the past 5 years that I've been leading this hike has come away disappointed with the tracks that they saw. So
this wildlife tracking hike takes place on February 12th, which is going to be followed by a BART class on the 13th that is also about wildlife tracking. What will be taught at that class with BARC?
So it's nice to do things kind of the other way, because that class is going to break down kind of like the thought processes and things that we go through to when we first come upon, especially like a footprint of an animal. So there's kind of, everybody has their own methods, but as a community, it's very kind of like oral and experimental and collaborative. And so we've developed ways of that we all believe of thinking about and breaking down your inquiry. And it's really good, even if you can't come to the mountain, I feel that way of making judgments of something that's in the tangible world, it kind of relates to like every type of decision or judgment that you make in your life, you know? It gets to a very philosophical place very quickly, but it also applies to how you interact with and see the natural world.
So people don't necessarily have to come on the hike the day before to go to the class?
Definitely not. I think You'll find that if you come to the class, you'll start tracking the minute you walk out of the room.
So Courtney, you've been organizing the upcoming BARC volunteer orientation. When and where is that taking place?
We have a lot of events coming up, so I definitely want to make sure people have that information. Volunteer orientation is the 16th. Of February. That is a great way for folks who haven't been involved with BARC or who don't know a lot about Mount Hood or new to the area to learn a little bit of the history of forest defense, about BARC's particular victories, and then some of the different events that are going on or ways that they can get involved right away. We will do a ground truthing training later in the spring, and that is the way that we train folks to go out and document the forest in areas that are proposed to be logged via the commercial timber program in Mount Hood, and teach folks the skills that they need to do the same kind of documentation that wildlife trackers will do. But we're looking at a lot of different parts of the ecosystem during ground truthing. We have a library space in BARC, which is kind of the way that we host a lot of our events. We also do activist trainings called Radical. That is a way that not only ground truthing, but we want folks also to understand policy and the different kinds of organizing tactics that we use to bring the message to the public from what's going on in the forest and to see changes on the ground in the management of public lands. I can give a couple of quick tips for folks if they want to check out upcoming events. There's always a hike and an ecology club each month in March. The Ecology Club and the hike are about place and belonging. And so it'll be special and storytelling. If you have a special part of Mount Hood that you think is meaningful to you, that's the kind of thing that we would encourage folks to come and do a hike leader training so that they might be able to bring BARC volunteers and the public out to that type of area. We'll do a hike leader training in May. And then on through the summer, there will be campouts and lots of field work, so anyone who kind of checks in with me during volunteer orientation time can get themselves set up to be more active in the coming months.
Cool. I just wanted to ask, you know, ground truthing is what BARC is really known for here in Portland. Can you kind of describe what that is in actual practice? What if a volunteer went out to do some ground truthing, what would their day kind of look like?
You would go out to a timber sale unit. So first, we would teach you to look at Forest Service maps to understand how to get to these places and how to identify when you're in a timber sale unit. Sometimes there's flagging and things like that, but often there isn't. And so you need to learn to read topography a little bit and understand what creeks and rivers look like on a map. Then once you get there, you'll start to document things like the species of trees, the density of the forest, how is it a dry or a wetter area, what wildlife do you see, what size are the trees? What is the slope? Is there signs of previous logging? Is there signs of fire? These, you know, things that you can just see with your eyes. We'll teach folks to take as much information in that way, document it, and we use that information then to comment on those projects and make our objections to timber happen or logging happening in those areas.
And you've seen ground truthing actually lead to a result for conservation?
Yeah, actually, there's a timber sale that's called the Hole in the Road Timber Sale. It's down along the Malala River. And just recently, 88 acres of that timber sale were dropped from the proposal because of, among other things, wildlife sign that was found in those areas, in those units. And so those 88 acres are saved for now. And it was the boots on the ground that gave us that information.
Wow. So for people that don't know, what is the state of the wilderness right now in around Mount Hood? Is it in danger of being sort of logged and sold into a dangerous ecological place, or is it relatively stable?
Sure, that's a great question, because wilderness is a particular designation for land, and that is the highest protection that public lands can get. And so in wilderness areas in Mount Hood, they are very well protected. There is no commercial logging in those areas. There's even limits on how much time you can spend there and how many people can be in a wilderness area at once. The rest of the forest that's not in a wilderness area is up for the commercial timber program to at least attempt to log. And so the environmental rules that are in place, like the Endangered Species Act, rules to protect drinking watersheds, and many other ecological sensitive areas are the kinds of laws that we use to challenge those proposals on any particular part of the forest where they're planned. And we kind of have our fingers crossed right now that we won't see too much opposition to those, you know, federal laws that apply to all public lands in the nation. But we do have some tricky things coming down the road at us, I would say, with the new administration.
And just in terms of the greater ecology of the region, Mount Hood is a really critical spot because we have this amazing wildlife corridor in terms of like regional green space and like wilderness, not the designation, but the real thing. We have a great amount of that to the south of us, and then a great amount of that to the north of us that connects all the way to the Rockies and up into Canada. But Mount Hood is a bottleneck. And I've heard people say that it is one of the most visited and one of the most logged national forests in the United States. So it's really, really critical. There are animals that we know are all around us, like animals like wolverines, but we haven't really been able to document them on this mountain, probably because of the high human impacts.
Well, we're almost running out of time here, but Courtney, I really wanted to ask you, Bark, here we are talking about hikes and all these things that people are going out and doing ground truthing. But what are there other volunteer opportunities for Bark that don't include having to go out and go snowshoeing and hiking and going out into the wilderness? What opportunities do people have here in the city?
In the city, you can help us by hanging out at events with us, working at the table, helping us get information out into the community. There are some research projects that I won't go into right now, but if you are a research person, you should come by. We have some facts and figures to crank out. I also am looking for folks who are interested in designing outreach materials and working on web design and things like that. So anything that you can imagine in the form of outreach that happens in Portland that you see on other issues or from other organizations, all those kinds of skills are really useful at Bark as well.
And I know you mentioned that there were a bunch of events coming up. So can you repeat those again for people who are interested in attending a Bark event?
So this week, actually tonight, there's a great event, Building Unity with Standing in the Spirit of Standing Rock, and we'll have local Indigenous activist and artist Jacob Johns. That's at our office tonight at 351 Northeast 18th. And then this weekend is the tracking hike. On Monday is the Ecology Club for Wildlife Tracking. Volunteer orientation on the 16th. That's also in our office. Then hike and Ecology Club about place and belonging as well in March. And I believe we have another organizing training coming up in March too. Hike leader training in May. More hikes and more hikes after that.
Wow.
No shortage of opportunities
get involved.
All right. Well, we're all out of time, unfortunately. I feel like we could keep going talking about
this for
another 20 minutes. But yeah, thank you both for joining us, and thank you and to our guests that haven't been as verbal, but much appreciated that you're able to join us here in the studio. So that was Courtney Ray from BARC and hiker leader Lila Brown from Cascadia Wild. To find out more about upcoming BARC hike, you can go to www.bark-out.org or find them on Facebook at BARC Out. To learn more about Cascadia Wild, go to their website at www.cascadiawild.org.
The FBI announced that the Freedom of Information Act requests will no longer be accepted by email. Beginning in March, people will need to ask for official FBI documents by fax, snail mail, or the Bureau's web portal. The Freedom of Information Act gives United States citizens the legal right to access unreleased documents controlled by the United States government. Critics denounced the change as a blatant attempt to make it more difficult for people to get information from the FBI by removing the most efficient way to make requests. They claim using the FBI's web portal is a poor substitute because it forces people to agree to terms of service, which include providing their physical address and phone number, and limits requests to one per day. The FBI has always been less than enthusiastic in its processing requests and has often taken longer than the 30 days to respond to them in direct violation of the law.
Though lawsuits around the country file against the rescinded so-called Muslim ban, some parts of the executive order are still in place. One active part of the Trump administration's executive order is a budget freeze or refugee resettlement agencies that receive federal funding. Catholic Charities USA, a refugee resettlement agency, predicts the order will cost the organization millions of dollars and cause layoffs of hundreds of jobs at the agency. The organization launched a fundraising campaign to compensate for the sudden lack of funds. Other agencies like International Rescue Committee and One World Relief are pursuing similar campaigns.
A new crack in Antarctica is growing on the ice shelf, also known as Larsen C, a third of the Larsen ice shelf. A crack has grown rapidly in the past 2.5 years, and since December, the crack has grown in length by 5 football fields each day. Geophysicists predict that once the crack reaches end to end, an ice piece the size of Delaware will break off.
The French far-right leader Marine Le Pen opened her presidential campaign on Sunday in Lyon, warning her flag-waving supporters of the two leading threats facing the nation: globalization and Islamism. In a packed hall, she delivered an hour-long speech specifically praising President Trump and the Americans who had elected him. Americans, she said, had, quote, kept faith with their national interest, unquote, and promised to do the same for France. Le Pen's National Front Party is closer than it's ever been to gaining power in France after over 40 years of existence. With the nation frightened by terrorism and weary of unemployment at around 10%, polls show that she is very likely to reach at least the second round of voting in France's two-stage electoral process this spring. The kickoff event showed how far the party has come from its origins in the early 1970s, when it emerged as a coalition of former Nazi collaborators and Algerian war veterans. Le Pen, buoyed by the Trump victory, outlined her major initiatives. She promised to hold a referendum within 6 months on European Union membership, which she called a, quote, a nightmare, secure the country's borders, and pull France out of NATO. Le Pen also placed negative attention on foreigners for using France's social benefits.
Steve Bannon has connections to the Vatican, according to a report today in the New York Times. Speaking at a conference in Los Angeles in 2014, Steve Bannon, a Catholic, spoke forcefully against what he termed as rampant secularization and the existential threat of Islam and a capitalism that had drifted from the moral foundations of Christianity. Conservatives in the Vatican heard that talk and thought highly of Bannon's vision of what they saw as a right-wing church militant theology. Since then, Bannon has made some friends in the Vatican, including arch-conservative American Cardinal Raymond Burke, who had openly clashed with Pope Francis. Burke criticized Pope Francis, saying that the Pope opened the door for divorced Catholics to receive communion. And just 2 weeks ago, the Pope stripped Cardinal Burke of his institutional influence after a scandal exploded at the Knights of Malta, a nearly 1,000-year-old chivalrous order that guards the Pope. According to the New York Times reporter Jason Horowitz, Burke and Bannon have since bonded over their shared worldview. While Mr. Trump, a twice-divorced president who has boasted of groping women, may seem an unlikely ally of Vatican traditionalists, many of them see his election and the influence of Mr. Bannon as potentially a game-changing breakthrough. The Pope will maintain his direction and not be distracted by fights against those who are trying to undercut him, a Vatican spokesman stated. He moves forward, and he moves ahead very fast. The spokesman added that Mr. Trump's ban on immigrants from certain Muslim countries was opposite of the pontiff's.
Homeland Security Secretary John F. Kelly appeared before House lawmakers Tuesday, where he faced questions about a number of President Trump's executive orders and their implementation, specifically the travel ban, border security, and directives involving immigration enforcement in the interior. While some so-called sanctuary cities have defended their policies to keep local policing separate from federal immigration enforcement, Texas is currently considering a bill that would force local police to make immigration enforcement part of their duties. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Appearing before the House Homeland Security Committee, DHS Secretary John F. Kelly took all responsibility for the, quote, haphazard rollout of President Donald Trump's executive order barring entry to nationals from seven Muslim-majority countries. Yet he repeatedly denied that any chaos ensued at customs entry points as a result. California Representative Nanette Diaz-Barragan.
How are we to know that there was no chaos down there? Members of Congress couldn't even see for themselves.
Well, you can take my word for it. If my people in CVP say there was no chaos, that they were doing their normal job at the counters with people coming into the United States, most of whom were allowed to pass, those that needed additional screening were put aside. This is normal, everyday operations in any airport in the United States. There was no chaos. Their job normally would not be, I mean, it would be unusual for someone to say, hey, I'm a congresswoman and I want to talk to people in CVP. In my opinion, they need to do their jobs on the spot.
The travel ban applies to nationals from Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen.